I'm John Kroll. This month is Mental Health Awareness Month. Today on No Limits, we're going to take a look at the status of mental health among Indiana's young people. We're going to look at challenges, and we're going to explore solutions. My guests are Indiana Youth Institute Vice President of Advancement, Glenn Augustine, and Maddie Zielinski, who runs the Youth Move Program for Mental Health America, Indiana. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Our email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about mental health today. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and specifically we're going to be taking a closer look at the status of mental health among Indiana's young people. If you'd like to join this important conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Indiana Youth Institute Vice President of Advancement, Glenn Augustine, and Maddie Zielinski, who is the State Coordinator for the Youth Move Program of Mental Health America of Indiana. There are a lot of ofs in there. I got tripped up on them. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us here, John.
Wonderful. Thank you.
It's good to have both of you here. So we probably ought to start by talking just a little bit, an overview of you know, what the numbers reveal about mental health among young people. We probably ought to start by defining who we consider young here. What group we're talking about. Glenn, I'll give you a stab at that first, but I'd like to hear Maddie's thoughts too.
Well, at the Indiana Youth Institute, we consider youth anybody from birth all the way up to when they get out of college.
Okay.
So that's what we loosely define as youth. Maddie, you may have a different definition.
Well, we specifically work with transitional aged youth, and that number is 14 to 25.
Okay.
14 is kind of the age that young people sort of drop out of the system, and then 25 is the age at which they're frontal lobes have fully developed, so we consider them more adult-minded.
John, that at age 14 is interesting for another reason, too, because about half of adult mental, emotional, behavioral disorders begin by the age of 14 and three-fourths by the age of 24. So that age range that Maddie's talking about, really a critical time in the mental health field for diagnosis and treatment.
So, but for the purpose of discussion, as people understand it, Glenn, some of your numbers may start from birth all the way up to, say, 22 or 23 years old, and yours start at 14 and they go a little bit further to 25. Mm-hmm. How are we defining mental health? It's a simple question, but I know.
I feel like we're gravitating more towards the thought of mental wellness,
mm-hmm.
Because everyone has mental health to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to emphasize it as your wellness and also looking at it more as being holistic, because we're also sort of learning that, hey, the mind and body are linked. So when you say mental wellness, you're looking at the entire spectrum.
What traits define mental wellness then?
There are certain attributes that can support that, like having a good support system. But then you also want to look at there's mental and emotional disturbances. And these things can happen to anybody, though. There's also daily stressors can just be an attribute to your mental health.
Things like coping skills, John. You know, how well can somebody, when Maddie's talking about those stressors, how well do they cope with those mm-hmm. stressors? And at what age can they deal with those on their own? Or do they need that support system Maddie mentioned as well to be able to cope with the stressors in their daily lives? And so those are some of the factors that play into the way we look at this as well. And in Indiana, we see some ways in which children, especially teenagers, do not appear to be coping very well with the stresses in their lives.
Well, and I guess the reason I ask the question from that way is mental health often seems to be one of those things, or mental wellness, to use the term that Maddie has provided here, is one of those things that too often I think we define in its absence, rather than saying this is what constitutes good mental wellness. These are the traits we should look for. So that's kind of what I'm looking for in asking the question. What are the signs that you are mentally well or mentally balanced? Because we are going to spend a lot of time talking about the trouble signs, the signs that someone might need a little bit of help or that there might be some causes for concern. But what are the traits, the things that we should aspire to that define good mental wellness? Glenn, I'm going to start with you.
I guess, John, really it would be sort of the opposite of those bad traits or the warning signs. Mm-hmm. Somebody, as I just mentioned, who copes well with stress, knows how to deal with stress when it comes up. They deal with it in an appropriate way, not acting out, in a negative way when stress has come about. Having a generally positive and healthy self-image about oneself and not taking out of control or risky behaviors would be another sign of someone who has a good mental health. Maddie, would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say having a routine, having a solid routine and feeling founded, I would say that you look at things like if they have a support system, like we're saying, if they have coping mechanisms, conflict resolution, I think, is a really powerful one. If you're able to assess an appropriate response to situations, a lot of times we act emotionally without higher thought. And I feel like that happens a lot in especially teenagers because, the emotional part of the brain is fully developed. You're born with that. You're always an emotional creature, but they don't have their frontal lobe fully developed, which is responsible for decision-making and assessing what's appropriate and what's not appropriate.
Or as I like to say, it's the part that is able to weigh consequence.
Yeah,
and a
filter.
About, what might occur as a result of this action.
Absolutely, and I think a lot of these things are focused in community. Does the person have a strong community around them? Because that's how we learn to socialize, and that's where these issues come from. When you socialize, you learn responses of people in these situations and what's appropriate and what's not and how are they going to respond and how does it make another person feel.
Well, do we have numbers on how well Indiana is doing in regards to mental health among young people?
We do.
Glenn, you're nodding your head.
I brought pages of them, John, because at the Indiana Youth Institute, we produce something called the Kids Count in Indiana Data Book. If you're interested in that, I would suggest you go online to IYI.org. You can download a copy for free. So a couple of things. When you look at how kids are faring in Indiana, we have about 5.3% of our kids have a behavior or conduct problem, 4% have a problem with anxiety, and 3% have experienced depression. And you look at those numbers, you say those percentages seem pretty low. I think the one thing we have to keep in mind is those are the children who are diagnosed. So we anticipate that those numbers would actually be higher than that. One area that we find of great concern in Indiana is happening among those Hoosier children ages 10 to 19, and it has to do with suicide. Suicide is the second leading cause of death among Hoosier teenagers. And sometimes when you start to dive into the numbers, John, you have to look at the sources. Things aren't always comparable in the way we would like them to be. So I want to be clear in these two statistics that I want to talk about right now. In the 2016 data book, what we reported was that 1 in 6 Indiana high school students have considered attempting suicide and 1 in 8 have made a plan for attempting suicide. That was in 2016. That's a statistic that we can only look at on a statewide level.
So 12.5% basically have made a plan.
Exactly. Yeah. Let's go to the year before, the 2015 data book, where we had Indiana had the highest rate in the nation when it came to kids who've considered suicide. That was nearly 1 in 5 just a year before that. And we had the second highest rate in the nation when it came to suicide attempts at 11%. So if you look at how we've compared in the nation just a year ago, you can see that we had extremely high numbers. That's a cause for concern. And the other cause for concern that we can talk a little bit more about and look at some of the numbers is where do children go to get treatment? Because in many places in Indiana, they will have a very difficult time finding treatment. Across the state, we say there's about one provider for every 750 750 Hoosiers, but in some counties, it's one for every 14,000. one for every 14,000. So in some communities, especially rural communities, where do you go for the help? There may not be a lot there. If you have transportation issues, which many people do in rural communities, it may not just be easy to get to that person. And then you get down to the whole insurance question, which we can dive into as well. So there are challenges for those out there who are facing challenges with their mental health.
Maddie, do those numbers track with what your group finds? And I'm going to advance the conversation a little bit by saying
I know that in some counties there are no providers at all.
Yeah, but the one in five to one in six number of Hoosier young people thinking about who have thought about suicide, does that track with your findings as well?
Absolutely, and you know, there's a lot of every young person in that age range experiences depression. Everyone mm-hmm. experiences depression. When we call it clinical is when it meets certain criteria, but I feel that our generation is under a lot of stress and there's a lot of isolation. Even though we are connected to each other socially, it feels void and empty. And I feel like isolation is what takes depression to thoughts of suicide, because you no longer feel like there's a purpose for you in the world. And I think this is even more extreme in our generation because our parents are not in the home anymore. There's not community interaction the way there used to be because they're gone just trying to make it by, working however many jobs they have to put food on the table. And so these youth are left at home alone with no real guidance and structure and family aspect to make them feel founded and safe.
What I want to get at, though, is presumably, you know, the economic forces and all of that that you're talking about apply in many places in this country. Why are the numbers the highest in Indiana? I mean, what is there something in there that indicates why Indiana would have this tragic and kind of dubious distinction of leading the nation and having young people thinking about killing themselves? Is there any evidence there? Glenn, you're looking thoughtful. I'm going to throw it your way.
Yeah, when you know, we look a little bit more at the numbers than we do at causes at the Indiana Youth Institute at times, and I don't think there's any one thing that we can put a finger on that says why this is. I think what we have to look at, John, is what those numbers point out is there obviously is a sense of desperation among many of our children. Mm-hmm. And we've talked a lot about we've touched on the rural aspect, and Maddie was talking about, you know, parents are not there, and especially in families with lower incomes where parents are trying to work a couple of jobs to put food on the table. You know, we also need to look at what is known as the price of privilege, and that is that even in higher income families, you can find children who are not doing well mentally. Oftentimes it's based upon the pressures that their community or their families place on them to succeed, to get into the best, you know, to have the high grade point average and to make sure you're doing all the extracurricular activities and that you're getting into the best colleges. And so even at higher income levels, we see children who are faltering with their mental wellness because of some of the pressures that are put on them, and they don't feel like they know where to turn. I think another thing we have to look at is the commingling of mental health with substance abuse issues. We know in Indiana that we have some issues with substance abuse, not only with alcohol and marijuana and some others, but, you know, we talk about the heroin epidemic. Those numbers seem pretty small among children, but the fact that any children at all are resorting to heroin shows you where they're turning in some of them, which comes from farming. You know, we have children who are trying to self-medicate themselves to deal with some of the issues they have. Sometimes it's because they see their parents doing that. But as more children have gotten access to opioids, you know, prescribed as pain medication and often left around the home, and we know that most children get their drugs of choice in the home, they after a while, if that doesn't give them the high they want, they will try to seek out something like heroin. So where we have that commingling of drugs and alcohol and a lack of mental wellness, that's another place where we start to see an issue. So I think there's just a combination of factors that we see out there. Whether we can put our finger on what that one cause is, I don't think is really possible.
I see a lot of hopelessness also from our generation because of the way that the world works now. Mm-hmm. It seems like we grew up and nobody really cares about us. They don't care if we have health care. They don't care if our parents have health care. They don't care if we have higher education. And even if we do get to go to college, we're going to be in crippling debt for the rest of our lives and having to work a job that we hate. And it just feels impossible to get ahead. So why even be alive at all if nobody cares about us? And if you don't want us here except to milk us for our money and make us slaves to a system, like that's just what it feels like from our generation's standpoint.
We are talking about mental health among Indiana's young. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. And my guests are Indiana Youth Institute's Glenn Augustine and Maddie Zielinski, who runs the Youth Move program for Mental Health America, Indiana. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about mental wellness, here on No Limits today. I cannot talk. That is an obstacle in radio. Because May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and we're taking a closer look specifically at the status of mental health among Indiana's young people. Our guests are Indiana Youth Institute Vice President of Advancement Glenn Augustine and Maddie Zielinski, who runs the Youth Move program for Mental Health America of Indiana. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. We've talked about the connection between substance abuse and many of these stressors. Maddie's also talked eloquently about, for lack of a better term, sort of the breakdown of the social contract, the sense that even if young people do sort of what we expect them to do, stay in school, they don't necessarily feel like there's going to be a place for them in the world at the end of that. How much of this is also driven by economic factors? I know from reading, and because we have done shows on the kids count, that if I remember correctly, 22% of the state's children live in poverty here. How much of that is a contributor to some of these pressures?
I think Maddie quite eloquently talked about that sense of hopelessness. And we certainly see that in children who live in poverty. There is a greater sense of hopelessness, that there's no way out of this, that I don't have the resources to lift myself up out of the circumstance that I'm in. And certainly, if you look at children in poverty, you see a number of factors that would play into them not having mental wellness. And I think, John, it's one of the reasons why at the Indiana Youth Institute we've talked a lot about mentoring. Mm-hmm. You know, as we talked a little bit earlier, many children who've come from poverty, families in poverty, oftentimes those families are working two and three jobs to try to put food on the table and a roof over their children's heads. They're just not quite making it that well. And so, and oftentimes, as Maddie pointed out, the parents aren't around. So I've been in a tutor in the Read Up program in Indianapolis Public Schools, and actually tutored a girl who was in fourth grade who was pretty much raising her siblings mm-hmm. because her parents worked all the time. So, you know, you see a situation like that, and for a mentor to come alongside some of these children and try to encourage them that you can do it, stick in school, you know, encourage them to stick in school, to use the abilities that they have. Children are resilient. They can overcome these things if they get the right inputs and that could be from a mental health professional, somebody maybe who doesn't has not been presented with some kind of mental health issue that's been diagnosed, might just need that encouraging word from a mentor. But there's certainly a ways in which poverty erodes that sense of hope that everyone needs to be able to succeed in life.
Are the economic factors drivers as far as you're concerned too, Maddie?
Well, I find this to be the money is always the end of every conversation that I have when there's an issue. Okay. But I feel like this spans all the way from
I'm sorry, if I could step in for when you say it's the end of every conversation you have, what do you mean by that?
When we're looking at trying to solve the problems in these mental health crises in these young people's lives, you know, we go through all of these, what can we do, try to make a strategic plan, try to, what can we actually do to help? And it always ends up with, there's not enough money and there's not enough providers. And it goes from all the way from the family at home. Like we're said, okay. We said many times, the parents aren't there because they're trying to work. So that creates, you know, not a good foundation to begin with. This also spans to the other end of the spectrum where there's a lack of providers because the cost of education is so high and the wages for this work are so low. So there's no motivation. And then even if you can get mental health services, the cost of them is outrageous. And so it plunges this family into financial crisis that is already has stressors on them to begin with. Right. And then it, and in the end, it often is less expensive to keep using drugs to stay depressed and all of these things than it is to try to get clean or try to get support.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I wanted to jump in on the point about the financial piece because we have heard this. One of the things that Indiana historically has been has done pretty well is insure our children, mainly through private employer provided health insurance. Indiana's unemployment rate right now is 5%. So we know that many families get health insurance through their employers, and then the state has a really good and robust system of health care for those who can't get the private care as well. Here's the challenge with that. In many of these cases, insurance will pay for, under an employee assistance program, typically about 5 free visits for per person, per issue, per year. So you may have a child who needs some mental health care from a professional, and you can get those 5 visits for free for your child in that 1 year. But if you need more than that, that's where Maddie's talking about the fact that the cost of the services can become quite prohibitive for families, and they just can't afford to get their child all of the care that the child may need. The child may need to go to a mental health provider for several years. So they are left between that choice of either taking on debt to care for their child or not getting the child the mental health care that they need because they can't afford it. So it puts some families in a very difficult situation. And it's something that I know a lot of leaders are trying to look at. How does it stack up so that we can provide more mental health care? Because I think there's a even among state lawmakers right now, as we look at the drug problem that we have in the state of Indiana, there's a real sort of thought shift happening there in that we need more treatment rather than incarceration, that we have to understand that those issues oftentimes take somebody 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe a dozen times to go through treatment before they're going to get clean. And so trying to provide those services from a societal standpoint, oftentimes it may cost more on the front end, but it costs less on the back end in the incarceration and social services that we might have to dedicate to somebody who gets in trouble. That's even true for youth. If we can get to their issues early, we can stave off some of the societal costs later on. So those kind of go hand in hand. Many of the same people who are treating drug and alcohol addictions are treating the mental health pieces. And as Maddie said, there's often not a financial incentive to get involved in the field because the pay is typically low and it causes a lot of stress as well. It's a high stress profession.
We are talking about mental health, mental wellness here on No Limits today. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. How much of this is also about, you know, we talk about the fact that there's not a lot of money that at any level. I mean, the family in some ways has disincentives to deal with the situation because it can add an economic stressor. And if they're already on the edge of economic disaster, that can create a real problem for them and add still more stressors to the system. It doesn't sound like we invest enough money as a state, as a society, in these issues. How much of this, and I'm asking this question from the basis of the fact there have been people I have known in my life that have strayed from mental health, I'll say it, and I've thought needed help. And when I've talked with them about it, the response often is the same. I can deal with this on my own. There's a social stigma almost that says, you know, it's a sign of weakness to say that you need help in this area. And we treat it differently than we say. No one would say, for example, with a broken arm, oh, I can deal with that myself. You go to the doctor and you get it dealt with. Maddie, how much of the obstacle of getting through this is getting past that stigma?
I think stigma plays a huge factor in receiving services because people don't want to be looked at with a label of being crazy or just any sort of label. In some ways, my generation has sloughed off a lot of that stigma. We're not really afraid to walk around and say, I have ADHD or I'm depressed or I have bipolar. That's actually pretty common. And so I feel that it's something that we're just sort of getting used to. Mental health isn't really a very old field if you look at it. And so there are entire cultures that are totally off-put by it and feel that it's a private thing and it shouldn't be talked about, anything like that.
Well, there are cultures that say it's a moral defect if you deal with this. Yeah.
Right. And so I feel like people feel stigmatized from their culture or from other ways. So I think that it plays a huge factor.
Glenn.
I think Maddie has hit on something there. I think it probably is a little bit more generational. I think my generation and older probably see and have that sense of a stigma perhaps more than the younger generation does. I can't quantify that with statistics or data, but I think, you know, as I look at friends and family, I think that's certainly true. And, you know, John, it is true. Your comparison there is really an interesting one. You wouldn't say, I've got a broken arm. I'm just going to let it dangle until it heals because it's not going to heal.
Or I'll fix it myself.
Right. It's not going to heal right. It's not going to be, you know, the limb will heal but probably won't function very well. And that we have to look at the mind in much the same way that without treatment, without some help, you may get over what you're dealing with, but what you're left with as far as, you know, some additional emotional damage that may come out then in your next phase of life, whether that's in a next relationship or in another job, if it hasn't been adequately dealt with, you're going to relapse. You're going to fall back into some patterns of behavior that others may find troubling or may not know how to deal with and will cause you additional issues. So we do have to get over the fact that there's some stigma with this. We need to deal with it just as we deal with any other part of our health. As Maddie said so well, it's really a holistic approach. It's not only physical health, it's mental health, and they play a factor. When you're in good physical health, you feel mentally better. When you feel mentally better, you're probably more likely to go out and get the physical exercise that you need. They really do go hand in hand. We can't look at them as separate pieces of a whole wellness picture.
Gotten an email from a listener whose first name I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to pronounce, so I apologize for that. It says, longtime listener, first time emailer, thank you for listening to the program. And if you want to send me a note sometime telling me how to pronounce your name, I will make sure I do it over the air. And I should say, if you want to reach out to us by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Listener says, I grew up in the Center Grove schools and area. There I was subject to constant abuse by other children that the school officials refused to address. Every day I was called fag so much, so I swear it was my nickname. I was finally forced to leave the school. What are we doing about the social and verbal abuse by other students? We talk about all these clinical issues and social issues as separate things, but they aren't. Please discuss. Maddie.
Well, there was actually a bully prevention law that was passed to help schools address when these sort of things happen. It's difficult to say whether this policy change has made an adaptive change within the schools yet. I know it's really difficult, but it is definitely something that's on the radar. It's one of the biggest issues in advocacy right now. My group is a youth-led advocacy group, and our predecessors worked very diligently to advocate for people who were subject to bullying and testified to make sure that bill passed so that there would be some sort of policy in place that would say that schools would address bullying. So whether that's being applied effectively, I can't say, but I can say that legislatively we have made changes.
The listener's question, though, how much of this speaks to, you know, the fact that we kind of put some of these issues in silos. And what I hear the listener saying is, you know, we need a holistic approach to this, that that the bullying can lead to some of these other problems. Glenn, you're nodding your head.
And it doesn't end at the school walls. I think that's one of the challenges we now have in society today, that it used to be if you were getting bullied at school, once you left the school grounds,
there was a safe zone.
There was a safe zone, and that was your home. But now with the social media and online, that bullying has become electronic as well. And I think it's one of those areas where one of the things we talk about quite a bit at IYI is the need for good communication between parents and their children. That needs to start at an early age so that your children feel secure in coming to you with the small problems, so that when the big problems happen, and they will, they're also comfortable coming to you to talk about those. And so oftentimes now children are looking for their validation online. How many likes will I get on my Facebook post? And we're actually seeing some children who are reacting negatively to not getting sort of the amount of attention they would like from a Facebook post. If you can imagine that, their self-image and self-confidence might be based on some part on that. And so, but also that this online bullying can happen. And so cyberbullying, it's called. And so children are not safe when they're away from the playground. And it's one reason why you see in Indiana, children will admit in surveys that they have carried a weapon either to or from school, while they're on school grounds, because they don't think that school is a safe place for them. They fear for their safety while they're at school. So it certainly plays a role. If you're going to school and you're not feeling secure there, that's going to play a role in your overall sense of security, of your overall sense of having hope, and in your overall mental well-being.
We are talking about mental health and mental wellness here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a call at 866-476-3881. Bill, welcome to the program.
Yes, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
My comment is, I would tell you, and you know, Maddie, no offense, but you sound very negative and without hope in some of the things you're saying, in that, you know, one of the things that, you know, you said this, well, they're going to have, people are going to go out and work in a job that they're going to hate. Well, you know, anything, any job that anyone goes to work in, they could either love or they can hate, and it becomes a personal choice. I mean, Henry Ford said, you know, if you think you can, or if you think you can't, either way, you're right. And what I would suggest is that we've got an issue where, you know, number one, we need to step back and try to find a positive way of approaching all this. As a society, we really depend upon all of us, you, me, and everybody else, to be contributing in some way. And sometimes in that means of contribution, we're not necessarily going to have all fun and games. We've got to, you know, work. Sometimes it's fun. Sometimes it's not fun. It's what we want to create that becomes the positive. And all I'm saying is that really it comes down to personal responsibility. And mental health, yes. I mean, everybody needs to be responsible. They need to be responsible for themselves. They need to be thinking about, it's not all about me, and it's all about us, us as a society, us as a family, us as a community, what part do I play in that? And what service can I provide? And I think there's lots of information out there. I'm not giving
I
you
totally
all
the agree.
Bill, thanks very much for the call and the comment. Maddie.
I totally agree, and I'm a huge advocate for having a positive mental attitude. I try my best to do that. And I work for a nonprofit group. I've taken a lower paycheck because I'm doing something that I love, that I feel like I am contributing to the community. I think that people in my generation feel, when I say that they hate that or a job that they don't like, it's not necessarily the job so much as the feeling that they're chained to the job because of their debt. That they have to do it because they're in this debt and they're never, ever going to get out of it. And that's where the hopelessness comes from.
We are talking about mental wellness, mental health issues here on No Limits, specifically among Indiana's young people. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. My guests are Indiana Youth Institute Vice President of Advancement Glenn Augustine and Maddie Zielinski, who runs the Youth Move Program for Mental Health America Indiana. If you'd like to join the conversation, send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about mental health, mental wellness. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and we're specifically taking a look at the status of the mental health among Indiana's young people. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits at WFYI.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Glenn Augustine of the Indiana Youth Institute and Maddie Zielinski, who runs the Youth Move Program for Mental Health America, Indiana. And I want to start this segment here with some thoughts from the show's producer, Shannon Cagle, who has written eloquently on these issues. Shannon says, we all remember what we didn't talk to our parents when we were teenagers. As the single parent of two teens, one of whom suffers from diagnosed depression, I find that it's imperative that I remind both of my kids early and often that I hear them even when they don't believe I am listening. It's hard, but I want them to think of me first when they feel like they're crumbling. That goes for the child who has apparent difficulties and for the one who doesn't appear to have apparent difficulties. Maddie, I'm going to ask for your thoughts on that.
I know that my mom has always been my strongest support system. So I do feel like having a strong parental relationship is important. And if not with a parent, because it's not always possible, with some supportive adult in your life, I feel is crucial to youth mental health.
What are the warning signs here? I mean, we've talked about this. We need to reduce it to a ground level. Let's say you are a parent like Shannon who does care, or just an adult somewhere who cares for children. When you see some behaviors among young people that should signal, oh, okay, maybe I ought to step in and indicate I do care here and try to provide a path to help. Glenn.
The National Alliance on Mental Illness lists, these are some of them that they list: feeling sad or withdrawn for more than 2 weeks, trying to harm or kill oneself or making plans to do so, out of control risk-taking behaviors that can cause harm to self or others, sudden overwhelming fear for no reason, severe mood swings that impact relationships, drastic changes in behavior, personality, or sleeping habits, not eating, throwing up, or using laxatives to lose weight, significant weight loss or gain, which can come from some of those other things, not eating, not sleeping, not taking care of yourself well, extreme difficulty in concentrating or staying still in school that can lead to academic failure, intense worries or fears that get in the way of daily activities, and repeated use of drugs or alcohol. So you can see how those are, you know, how we list them for children, but you can see how those also play in adults as well. Instead of academic failure, it can be failure at work. So those are some of the warning signs that are out there.
And if you see one of those warning signs, Maddie, or several of them, how do you structure the conversation when you approach the person who might be hurting?
Well, you know, we've all heard, you know, if you're being depressed, if you're having outbursts, I look for people who seem like they are feeling isolated. I feel like is the biggest factor, isolation. And saying sort of cryptic things is where I take my cue. If they say something, we call them invitations when we're talking about suicide prevention and alertness. Saying things like, I just don't want to do it anymore. I can't do anything right. Things would be better if I wasn't here. Like, those are sort of invitations to talk about suicide. And when you hear those, we have to make sure that we ask open-ended questions and we ask directly. We, you know, you want to avoid asking questions like, there's nothing wrong, is there? Or, you know, because they're going to say no. You're asking them to say no. And you don't want to say things like, are you thinking about hurting yourself? Because that can be misinterpreted. And a lot of people look at, when they're thinking about suicide, they're thinking about it as relief from pain.
I know we've done shows before where we've talked with people who have studied the impact of ACEs. I still think that that's one of the least applicable acronyms in the history of acronyms, adverse childhood experiences and how they affect people's development. And one of the things I took away from that was that they said that the conversation really shouldn't start with, what is wrong with you or is anything wrong, but sort of more what happened or what is going on. You know, those kinds of things that don't carry the weight of judgment with them. Is that a good way to start the conversation? If you see a young person who might be hurting, is to start by asking what is going on?
I feel that that question is probably the biggest shift that we could make in children's mental health, to not look at the child and saying what's wrong, but what happened. Because often these are children who have experienced trauma, and they're just trying to process that trauma. They don't know how. Mm-hmm. I also think that this is an indication a lot of times that the parents need support. When we're looking to treat a child, it's really difficult to treat a child if their parent is unstable as well.
Glenn.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, John, is this is where oftentimes we don't know where to turn, you know, as parents. And the first place you could turn is to your pediatrician. Your pediatrician can do at least a small screening of your child, and then could recommend a mental health professional if that is the determination that of where you need to go. So I think that, you know, we need to think about that it's not just, oh, my gosh, my child is acting this way, I have no idea where to go. Think about your family doctor. Talk to your family doctor first and get their advice. That may be the first step in providing the care that you need for your child.
Gotten an email question from a listener named Elizabeth, and if you'd like to reach out to us via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Elizabeth writes, I recently heard the saying, if you're hysterical, it's historical. In other words, families pass this distress down through generations, from father to daughter, mother to son, and the way they treat their children. The depression, addiction, emotional issues are learned and transfer through the generations. Mental fitness is so important and so poorly addressed in our healthcare system. Additionally, divorce and broken families are now the norm as opposed to the exception. It is all of our responsibilities as a society, a healthcare system, neighbors, extended families, and parents to do better by ourselves so we can do better by our children. We need to lose the stigma and deal with the costs associated with mental health care as aggressively as we market flu vaccinations. You're nodding your head, Maddie. I think I hear an amen.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the brain, you know, the brain is an organ, and it has inherited features, just like any other feature that you inherit. And it is nature and nurture together. I do believe that we should address mental health issues. And I think that, and for the people who feel stigmatized and they don't want to seek that support, or they have fear in their communities, I feel like go to your community and be a part of your community. You know, go to your pastor or reverend or wherever it is that your community gathers and get support in that way. Because I really do think that that's the best thing that we can do, is come together and support each other and learn about each other.
Well, and it's one of the things, and I guess we probably ought to speak to some of the hope on the other side, because this can be in and of itself a depressing subject. One of the things that when we've dealt with this subject in the past on this show, we've heard over and over again, is often it only takes one person, one adult, to say, I care, to make a difference and to do that. Glenn, what are the best ways to say, if you see someone, a young person who is hurting, I care?
I think that's just it. Hey, how are you? How's your day going? You know, I think, John, Maddie mentioned neighbors, and I think that's one place where support systems in general have sort of eroded in the society that we live in. It used to be that I ran my neighborhood back home in Belleville, Illinois, and every mom in that neighborhood knew who I was, knew where I belonged, knew my parents' phone number. And if I did something wrong in the neighborhood, you can bet before I got to 58 Whiteside Drive, the call had been made there, and my mom was waiting for me with the information she needed to deal with my behavior.
And the folks at 58 Whiteside Drive in Belleville right now are really glad you tossed that address out there.
But, you know, the fact of the matter is that you know, it's those neighborhood bonds that we've lost in some ways, and that whole fact of a caring adult. So where you get your community now is somewhat different, right? That you you can get it through youth groups at church. You can get it through after school programs. You can get it. You might still get it in some neighborhoods where there are adults who take an interest in the role of kids, or you might get it in a sports league. But the other thing is, in some of these programs, you look at an after-school program, one of the trainings we do a lot at the Indiana Youth Institute for youth workers is trying to identify children who are victims of trauma, because they're just not trained to identify. They see a behavioral problem. They don't know where that behavioral problem is coming from. If it's coming from just a behavior issue that's maybe propped up, or if it could be something a little more difficult dealing with that child's mental wellness. So we don't always have those support systems in place in the communities in which children are. But it's very important that those other caring adults say, I do care about you. How are you doing? And taking an interest in children so that they know there may be somewhere else they can turn.
How much of this, because it sounds like in a slightly different context, we're talking about the sense of isolation that Maddie's been talking about, too, that a lot of the structures we have now, you know, even after school programs and all of that, are much more formal rather than mm-hmm. the kind of informal and understood shared responsibility of earlier years. I mean, I was born in a very lower working class neighborhood in Cleveland, Ohio, and it wasn't until so people didn't have a lot of money or anything like that. There were a lot of stressors in that regard. It wasn't, though, until I was in my 20s that it occurred to me that the fact that all the kids in the neighborhood would end up playing in a yard where two or three of the mothers had gathered for cups of coffee in the morning so that they were supporting each other and we were all getting that kind of supervision wasn't a coincidence mm-hmm. that had been worked out, and that was the way it happened. I don't see as much of those kinds of relationships now, that kind of informal network now.
People don't really have time for it.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't, and they don't have energy for it. The world is so exhausting. Our stresses are so high. And at the end of the day, we can barely spend time with the people who live in our own house, much less try to build a community involvement. I think that there's a lot. You know, you said we live sort of in this structure now, and I think that leads to a lack of creativity and a lack of expression for young people. Everything is so formalized, where we've been alive as, you know, there's always been these machines that run everything for us. And so when you don't have that expression and that creativity and you don't have that outlet, we don't even realize that what we're feeling is a lack of control over mm-hmm. our environment. Because everything we assume is mechanized and someone else's responsibility to fix if it breaks. And I think that leads to a lot of mental struggle mm-hmm. for our generation. I think that one of the things that an adult can do to reach out if they see a young person feeling that way in their life is really just listen. And don't listen to try to fix their problems. Just listen. Avoid the word should. You mm-hmm. should do this. Let them repeat themselves. Let them repeat their story. Let there be silence sometimes. And just let them know that someone is there that is actually listening and actually cares.
Gotten an email from a listener named Cheryl. If you'd like to reach out to us via email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Says, I want to give a shout to IYG. There's no evidence-based studies on LGBT youth and suicide. The staff at IYG are putting together an evidence-based study for this particular group of youth, as they are very vulnerable to suicides. And my producer, Shannon, also has added also the counselors at Reach for Youth, and wanted me to emphasize that they've been guests on No Limits in the past as well, that we deal with this subject. That leads into this question of resources. And we've established that they're stretched thin, but there are resources out there for families that are troubled. If you're dealing with a situation, let's assume, and we'll get it out there before you, if someone is really on the verge of doing something self-destructive, the best outlet is to call 911 and call for help immediately. But say that you are at the beginning of that kind of descent and you want to try to slow it or reverse it if possible. Where are places you can call for help? Maddie, I'll start with you.
Well, if you need things like social supports, food stamps, welfare, things like that, any sort of referrals to doctors, That all that can be found by dialing 211. It's pretty easy. That's, I would say, the fastest way for a general blanket if you need support. I also think that for as far as youth in crisis, if they are feeling depressed or suicidal, like they are in crisis, they can call. Well, I say call because I'm so used to that, but we actually are moving towards texting crisis lines because young people don't really want to make a phone call. They don't want to be on the phone. It's comfortable for them to text. So there's actually texting crisis lines, services that they can use that I've found have been growing in popularity. It's just easier.
Where should they? Is there a place where they can find those texting crisis lines?
Mental Health America of Indianapolis runs a crisis line. I wish I could tell you what the number is right at this moment, but you can just Google texting crisis lines.
And the other thing I guess I would say, since I've dropped it in, we could add this to our Facebook page, too, on this. So if you need that information, we'll ask Maddie or someone else to plug in on our Facebook page at No Limits WFYI what information there is. Glenn, where would you recommend that people reach out to?
I would say the same thing. 211 is a great resource to get help and to get referrals, quick referrals, to a wide variety of resources. And again, I would say if you're a parent and you have a pediatrician, I would say reach out to your pediatrician. That may be the first step in getting the help that you need for your child. And again, please don't be afraid to reach out. Your pediatrician is ready to deal with this just as they are with the common cold or the broken bone. As you mentioned earlier, John, we need people to reach out and get their children the help and the support that they need. Because as we said, many of these behavioral issues and mental health issues start at the age of by the time children are 14, they've got a mental health issue that will follow them into adulthood. So we need to have early intervention and treatment.
Maddie, I want to give you a chance. You're holding up the phone. So I'm
I found the number.
That's great. Thank
so
you.
So the Mental Health America of Indianapolis, they have a crisis and suicide intervention service. You can call the phone number. It's 317-251-7575. But they also have the texting service also, which you're going to text CSIS to 839-863.
Give that to them again real quickly.
You'll text CSIS to 839-863.
And I would like to thank both of my guests, Glenn Augustine and Maddie Zielinski, for what has been an important and thought-provoking conversation. Also like to invite our listeners to come back on Thursday when we're going to dive into the challenges confronting foster care in Indiana. I am John Krall. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cherzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.